It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, studies comparing brain cells in human and non-human primates may be able to tell us a lot about how our brains work. A Wisconsin researcher shares the latest findings. Now, some significant changes are coming to Congress after the midterm elections and the upcoming lame duck session. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced last week that she will not seek re-election to her leadership role in the Democratic Party, but she will remain in office as a U.S. representative.
And with great confidence in our caucus, I will not seek re-election to Democratic leadership in the next Congress. For me, the hour has come for a new generation to lead the Democratic caucus that I so deeply respect. And I'm grateful that so many are ready and willing to shoulder this awesome responsibility.
Republicans will take majority control of the House next year. Current Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy was challenged in his own party by Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona. In the Senate, Democrats maintained control with Majority Leader Chuck Schumer at the helm. Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell faced a challenge from within his own party. We're looking at the future of Congress, its leadership amid divided government, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping to see from Congress in the next session? Are you worried about gridlock with a split House and Senate? Are you hopeful for some kind of agreement on key issues? If so, which ones? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ruth Block Rubin is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago and author of the book Building the Block, Intra-Party Organization in the U.S. Congress. Ruth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start by looking at the leadership in Congress. A big change for House Democrats, a big generational change with Speaker Pelosi and other top Democratic officials. Were you surprised to see this coming?
Well, I think it's only been a matter of time. There was certainly pressure within the party to turn things over to a new generation. I think it's hard to imagine the Democratic caucus without someone with Pelosi's experience at the helm.
Can you talk a little bit about the Nancy Pelosi era as a House Speaker or House Minority Leader, depending on the circumstances at the time? This is a decent chunk of American political history here.
Yeah, it's an incredible period of time. And she's been one of the longest serving speakers in all of House history. And certainly in recent memory, it's been an incredibly productive time legislatively. Pelosi's responsible for shepherding through some of the biggest legislative landmarks of the past 30 years. Perhaps the Affordable Care Act is the one of the crowning achievements, but even recent COVID legislation would not have passed without her help. But at the same time, we've seen someone who's shown an incredible mastery at managing a quite divided caucus. I think Democratic leaders are going to have their hands full managing moderate Democrats and progressive Democrats as ably as Pelosi has managed over the years.
And then Hakeem Jeffries of New York, expected to be the replacement now as House Minority Leader, would be the first Black leader of the Democratic Party in Congress. So how significant would that be?
I think incredibly significant. I mean, the Democrats have shown they're a caucus of change, and the party's leadership has reflected that, which I think is intentional. The best way to demonstrate progress is to show that in your leadership, and they've done that.
On the Republican side of things now, Republicans will be taking a narrow majority in the House next year. Kevin McCarthy, currently the leader of the party in the minority, got support from the bulk of his caucus, it looks like, but there could be some rocky roads ahead. What are you watching for there?
Well, I think his bid for speakership on the floor will be quite interesting, but then legislating, if he's, I suppose one could say, lucky enough to become speaker. Being able to manage such a narrow majority is difficult in the best of circumstances. And not only does he have an organized right wing in the House Freedom Caucus, but the party's remaining moderates have suggested that now's the time for them to start flexing their muscles. And that's not going to be an easy dynamic to manage. I mean, in some ways, Pelosi offers a good model for how to do that. Whether McCarthy is able to follow her lead will be an entirely different thing.
We are talking about the new look for Congress coming up next year. In a bit, we'll look at what divided government is going to mean in terms of legislation, investigations, confirmations, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you hope to see from the next Congress? Or is there something that worries you? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Finally, on the Senate side of things, Ruth, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, again, trade spaces, or no, they hold their spaces, I should say. Chuck Schumer remains the majority leader for Democrats. Mitch McConnell holds his position leading a large minority in the party. Mitch McConnell faced a challenge, at least from Rick Scott in Florida. It was slapped down, but 10, I think, of his colleagues voted against McConnell. Was that significant? A significant protest against McConnell's leadership?
Well, I think any vote against McConnell has to be considered somewhat significant given the level of control he's exercised. But do I think he's sleeping fine at night? I would think so.
Now, let's get into what actually happens in Congress with divided government. First of all, legislation. Do you expect to see much? It doesn't seem like there's a lot of prospect for bipartisan cooperation. Do you see some?
Well, one never really knows. And so that's always the an important hedge. But I don't think that what we've seen or what has been said about what House Republicans' ambitions are would lead us to think that they are interested in a positive legislative agenda. If anything, I think we might imagine they'll be spending quite a bit of their time investigating the president and members of the executive branch. And, you know, in some ways, that's not necessarily problematic for Democrats if part of the goal here is, you know, to show what Republican solutions are. If there aren't any, then that's an opportunity for Democrats, too.
Right. Republicans have signaled that there will be some investigations in the House related to Hunter Biden, President Biden's son, and allegations of influence peddling over the years that President Biden was Vice President Biden. Do you think that'll be front and center, or do you think you'll see Republicans talk about inflation and crime and the other issues they ran on this year?
It's certainly possible that there'll be a lot of talk about those issues. Whether there will be substantive legislative solutions is a different question. As to the Hunter Biden potential investigations, I think it's likely that we'll see some of that. But whether that will be politically problematic for them, as Democrats had concerns even about impeachment investigations, investigations aren't always a win-win for the investigating party.
One tool Republicans have in Congress to try to actually advance legislation or block spending and things like that would be the debt ceiling and the possibility of saying, hey, if you want us to pass a debt ceiling increase, here are some changes we need. How much leverage do you see that giving Republicans?
Well, I think it will certainly create a conflict within the Republican conference over whether this is the right lever to extract concessions from Democrats. And for that reason, one might suspect that in the lame duck session, there'll be some efforts to try and circumvent that as a possibility. But I think this is where the tight majorities are really going to matter for McCarthy. You'd imagine that there are some moderate Republicans who really don't want to see the debt ceiling used as a hostage. And so there may be pressure not to use it in that way. Who will win out is, again, anyone's guess.
We're taking a preview of what's next in Congress after the midterm elections with University of Chicago political science professor Ruth Block Rubin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the lame duck session, the time that remains between now and when the newly elected Congress is sworn in? What would you like to see this Congress accomplish on its way out? What do you want to see happen now with Democrats keeping close control of the Senate, Republicans taking a narrow majority in the House? Is there something you want them to cooperate on that you think they could cooperate on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with University of Chicago political science professor Ruth Block Rubin. With us today, looking at what's in store for the next Congress and what's left of the current one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping to see, if anything, Democrats get done before they lose control of the House in January? What do you want to see happen in the so-called lame duck session? And for 2023, are you glad to see divided government? Do you see an upside there? Do you see room for compromise and cooperation? Are there things you're hoping one party or another does with its control of a chamber of Congress? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ruth, you mentioned that lame duck session and possible action by Democrats to prevent the debt ceiling and spending bills being used to as a negotiating tool for Republicans. What kind of things might they be able to do over the next month and a half or so?
Well, it isn't a lot of time to legislate, but and Speaker Boehner did this before he exited, is essentially clearing out the barn. And so perhaps the debt ceiling is the biggest on the to-do list, which is essentially to remove all of the things that are likely to be impediments, and that in this moment in time, you could get some compromise. So I'd imagine that this would be the issue Democrats and Republicans would be most anxious to resolve.
Are there any other pieces of on the legislative agenda that you're watching for over the next month or so?
I think realistically, it's hard to imagine what will get passed until there's greater clarity on who is likely to be leader. People may be more willing to negotiate if they have a sense of who's going to be speaker.
One more thing that came out of this election is Democrats keep control of the Senate, which means that they keep control of the confirmation process for a lot of judge appointments, cabinet appointments, and others if things should open up. Could you tell us what that means in terms of President Biden's ability to advance his agenda in those arenas?
Well, I think that this will be full steam ahead on confirmations and stocking open places on the federal bench for nominees that are favorable to Democrats. This is something that Minority Leader Mitch McConnell showed was an incredibly valuable way to affect policy change. And it is one that does not require control over the House. So I can only imagine that the Biden administration is mustering their resources and getting ready to collaborate extensively with the Senate to turn the crank.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Bart is with us in Rhinelander. Bart, hi.
Hey, how are you? Happy Thanksgiving.
To you too. What did you want to bring up?
You know, it's just a lot of people have mixed emotions, feelings about, you know, voting. And I empathize. But like I was telling your colleague, all right, you know, it goes back to basically what we learned during the L.A. riots. When Rodney King said out nicely, can't we just all get along? Now that we are basically struggling as a nation for resources and all that, I think right out, this is the year we need to actually put, you know, our differences of politics all aside and get back to what we need.
Bart, thanks for the call. Ruth, do you see any prospects for Democrats and Republicans to get along and get things done in Congress?
Well, perhaps the best opportunity for a bipartisan accord is now. Pelosi and McCarthy have a famously difficult relationship, and so perhaps having new Democratic leadership will allow for an opportunity to extend the olive branch, or at least to be on speaking terms with leaders of both parties. And that's where opportunities for collaboration do exist. And so to the extent that one is more optimistic after a leadership change, this would certainly be one of those moments.
Thanks a lot for that call, Bart. Ruth, I got to say, one of the happiest faces I've ever seen in the news is Speaker John Boehner moments after he announced he was resigning as being House Speaker. Could you talk about the challenge of that job?
It's an incredibly difficult position. And not only do you have to have an incredible knowledge of House procedure to schedule legislation to ensure that it moves through at the pace that it does, but and a substantive knowledge, you also have to know your members incredibly well. And the House is a big place. So you need to know what motivates members, what their constituency needs are. You need to be able to keep all of that together. You need to be a good manager of the different people who are working for you, your whips, your deputies, and you need to keep everybody on the same page moving together. And that is very difficult. And Nancy Pelosi has made it look incredibly easy. But I think, as we'll see, it is not so easy to manage either the Democratic caucus or the Republican conference, either in the majority or in the minority.
One question I keep wondering about, Ruth, over the years is earmarks. So, you know, where, hey, if you vote for this, you get a, you know, a museum in your district or some road repairs or whatever. They were once really common. They kind of became a dirty word, got banned. I think they're starting to make an appearance again. Is that something that can grease the wheel to either help one manage one's own party or to, you know, buy a little bipartisan confirmation from the other?
Yeah, I mean, I think earmarks get a bad rap, but they are a way to make sure that people are compensated for the votes that they're taking, even when they're difficult for them or their constituents. And so in that way, we can see it as not so much a quid pro quo, but a recognition that policymaking has to happen on a variety of different dimensions. And you're asking different kinds of people to make different kinds of sacrifices. Republicans had famously tied their hands and refused to use earmarks for a while. And I don't think that made their legislating life all that easy. Democrats have been more open to them. And I think we've seen their legislative success is in part a part of having a wider array of tools to keep the caucus together and to gather the votes that you need.
The way our district lines are drawn in the United States, a lot of safe seats are there in the House in particular. Do members of Congress have more fear from losing a seat to a primary challenge if they're too willing to compromise with the other side than, you know, actually losing it to the other party?
I mean, I think when you talk to members, you get the sense that they're scared of everything. And so it's hard to know what exactly the deeper fear is. But certainly the primary being fear of being primary today, even if you're in a very safe seat, is a real one and has changed the dynamics for when leaders are pressuring members to make a vote. It used to be that if you were from a safe seat, you knew and the leadership knew that you could take the hit. And it's harder to do that today because every member has a story they can tell their leadership about how this might be the vote on which they're primaried.
Ruth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ruth Block Rubin is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago, authored the book Building the Block, Intra-Party Organization in the U.S. Congress. She joined us for a preview of the Congress of 2023 with divided control, Republicans having a narrow majority in the House, Democrats same in the Senate. A new restaurant in Superior is a rarity. It's a black-owned business in northern Wisconsin. Economic data show that people of color are more likely to struggle with getting capital to start their own businesses. State officials and nonprofits are hoping to change that, and they're expanding their efforts with some $75 million in federal COVID-19 relief set aside for diverse business programs. Danielle Kading has more.
Homemade batter sizzles on a waffle iron as Natalie Harris looks on. 3.5 mouth-watering minutes later, and it's ready to serve.
So there we go. This is golden brown and delicious the way a waffle should be.
Natalie and her husband, Cal, love waffles. It was always a secret dream for the Superior couple to one day own their own tea and coffee shop with a waffle bar on weekends. To make it a reality, they got help from a nonprofit lender that with a walk.
And we went on a road trip, and on that road trip, we kind of said, hey, let's do this. Now is the time.
The two headed for Yellowstone National Park. As the miles piled up, so did ideas for waffle recipes that Natalie scribbled on napkins. Ideas like topping waffles with warm apple crisp or cheesecake, one of Cal's favorites. Somewhere along the way, Cal says they thought, why not do waffles all the time?
We just felt like it was just going to shine. And it was going to be something for the community and something special.
Last summer, the two opened Superior Waffles in Superior's downtown. The wide open space has rows of tables and a display of waffle-themed items for sale. On the wall, the message, "All are welcome here," surrounds a heart-shaped waffle. Building the business didn't happen overnight. They took classes, connected with other business owners, and got a microloan through the nonprofit lender Entrepreneur Fund. Natalie is white and Cal is black. Black-owned businesses are rare in northern Wisconsin, and state funding aims to change that. Speaking at an event in Superior, Carly Vigu of the Entrepreneur Fund says the nonprofit is now expanding its services across northern Wisconsin.
In the 12 counties that we will be expanding to, we will be reaching at least 500 entrepreneurs.
The expansion is made possible with the help of $8 million in COVID-19 relief through Wisconsin's diverse business programs. Department of Administration Secretary-designee Kathy Blumenfeld says the goal is to help those hardest hit by the pandemic.
Those that have struggled and traditionally not maybe had access to capital or to expertise to help them start a new business.
Stephanie Williams is a business advisor for the Entrepreneur Fund with a focus on Black and Indigenous business owners and people of color. She says the expansion aims to provide more loans, grants, and technical assistance to underrepresented communities.
We don't have traditional stories. We don't have traditional generational wealth to pass down, and I'm trying to change that narrative.
Wisconsin has more than 462,000 small businesses. While racial minorities make up 11% of workers, they own roughly 7% of businesses in Wisconsin. Cal and Natalie Harris put their own money into the waffle shop, but Cal says the loan they received made a huge difference with buying equipment and setting up the business.
And everyone that comes through, they like always compliment us on how the space looks and feels, and we put a lot of time and effort into it, but it wouldn't have been possible without money, so that was really important to us.
Back at the waffle shop, Natalie says they want to see more diverse businesses grow in northern Wisconsin and give back to others. She says help is out there.
There's, you know, organizations like the Entrepreneur Fund, the Small Business Development Center. They want to help. That's what they're there for. So if people can just get connected, there's help and assistance.
The Entrepreneur Fund is already ramping up lending. The nonprofit plans to start working with northern Wisconsin communities in January. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the world's population just crossed the 8 billion mark. That's a lot of humans. Look at the impact of a growing population. That's at 7. Then it's a Thanksgiving week food conversation. Tackling one of my weak points in the kitchen. I make food that tastes pretty good and the texture's good. Ah, but what about the presentation? A lot of my food just looks like, well, a pile of glop. A food stylist joins the show to get you ready for Thanksgiving to make food that isn't just tasty, but has some artistic presentation to it. If you have a food presentation secret or question, let us know right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's all tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. Are humans the only species that can dance? Not just move around randomly to music, but actually move to the rhythm of the music. Mostly just us humans do it, but there are a couple species that appear to be able to do it too, including rats. As reported by Smithsonian Magazine and new research in the journal Science Advance, researchers put rats to the test with music from Lady Gaga, Queen, Mozart, Michael Jackson, and Maroon 5. Without any advanced training, the rats showed the ability of what they call beat synchronization. Their faces twitched along to the beat of the music. These are tiny movements. They had to use sensors to track them. I watched a video. If you're looking for a bunch of headbanging rats moving their whole heads to the beat, you're not going to see that. But on the upside, there's still better dancers than me. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up this hunting season, the DNR is continuing its deer donation program, which helps support food pantries around the state. We'll find out how it works and check up on chronic wasting disease in the state's deer herd. Now, while we may not look a lot like a chimpanzee or a marmoset, our brains have a lot in common. Wisconsin researchers studying the brain cells of human and non-human primates have found similarities and key differences that could help answer questions about developmental and psychiatric disorders. Andre Sosa is an assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience at UW-Madison, focusing on human brain development and evolution. Andre, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Andre, what kind of things can we learn about human brains from looking at our primate cousins?
Actually, it is essential to look at our cousins, let's say, because to understand what is unique about our brains, we need to compare them to the closest species we have. And only then you are able to distinguish what is different and what those differences mean in terms of function, behavior, cognition, and potential vulnerability to diseases.
And you're looking at a part of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. As I understand it, only primates have that. What does this part of the brain do for us and chimpanzees and everyone else?
Yes, that's correct. It's a structure that only primates have, at least with these characteristics. And it's very interesting because it's involved in certain aspects of cognition that are particularly special in primates in terms of working memory, high cognitive function, also personality traits, exploratory behaviors. So lots of things that we associate with primates and especially with humans. And of course, when some of these functions are disrupted, you can also lead to some psychiatric disorders that are so common nowadays in humans as well.
And you looked at the cells in this part of the brain. How much do we have in common? How much is different between us and non-human primates there?
Well, that's a very good and a very hard question to answer. So we identified 114 cell types in just this particular brain region, and only five of them were not present in the brains of all these species. One was absent in marmosets, one was only present in marmosets, and the other three were present in either humans or humans and chimpanzee. But that's just different cell types. Even when the cells are the same, let's say it's like apples. We are comparing apples to apples, but there are several types of apples, right? Mm-hmm. And so we are able to distinguish between even cells that are similar, what are the differences among those cells. And then we find many more differences than just comparing cell types.
And I mentioned this could help us answer questions about developmental disorders, psychiatric disorders. What are you hoping to learn from these kind of cells that can help with those disorders?
So, for example, we found one cell type that expresses one gene that is being associated to a lot of psychiatric disorders when the function of this gene or the expression of this gene is disrupted. And we found that this gene is expressed in commonly across several cell types between human and the other primates, but only in humans is expressed in this special cell type that is the immune cell type of the brain called microglia. And a lot of these disorders have been implicated with and associated with inflammation processes. So now we have a new idea on how to study these, right? Now it will be very interesting to know what this gene is doing in microglia in humans, for example.
Now, we've got a lot of evolution between us and, say, even our closest relatives like chimpanzees. What in evolution led, do you think, to these the development of these different unique cells in this important part of our human brains?
So there are several processes. Of course, what drives evolution is mutation, right? You have alterations in the gene structure, in several parts of the genes lead to different types of evolution, of course. But the accumulation over these last 6 million years, actually have accumulated a lot of differences, not only the brain, but of course in the rest of the body. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, we don't look very much like chimpanzees at first glance, although if you look more carefully, we do look a lot compared to the other species. But yeah, so these mutations will alter the function of the proteins and also will change the places and the amount of expression of these proteins. So when you start accumulating all these small, small, small differences, you generate an impactful difference, right? It's like filling up a bucket full of water, and at the end it's one drop that makes it go out, right? So it's similar in that sense. You have several accumulation of several small differences that eventually will generate an impactful difference.
What are the next steps now in this research, now that you've found these unique cells that only humans have in this key part of the primate brain?
So we are now studying first developmentally, where do they come from? Where in the brain are they generated? Because usually these cells come from a different part, from progenitor cells, and then they migrate to their final places. So we want to understand what is their developmental origin. And we are very interested, of course, in understanding their function. By manipulating now the expression of these genes, we can start having a good idea on what is the impact of having specific gene expression programs or specific cell types in the brain.
Do you think that this could eventually lead to something therapeutic in the future?
It's hard to tell, but I think it's an important first step to understand what is different between our brain and the brains of other species, to try to grasp exactly that, right? We need to target those differences to start developing therapeutical avenues. Because, to be honest, before we know how to treat a disorder, we need to know how the system works normally, right? To then understand what are the disruptions and how can we bring it back to a normal working brain.
Andre, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Andre Sosa, assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, focusing on human brain development and evolution. He joined us to share some of his team's research on human brains, primate brains, and key differences in a key part of those brains when it comes to brain cells. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about hunting and family.
For many Wisconsin families, hunting is an annual tradition rooted in customs and love. But what happens when those traditions are disrupted, when members of that deer camp are no longer with us? Ron Weber shares his experience with this in A Hunt to Remember.
There was no doubt about it. I was lost. In 35 years of hunting the Shawamigan National Forest near Clam Lake, I had been turned around many times, but never lost. Earlier that morning, I said goodbye to my older brother Rick and Terry, a longtime deer camp compadre. Their departure left me the sole occupant of the small cabin on the crooked shores of Lake Namakagan. Just 3 years earlier, it had been its usual cluttered self as we gathered for those 9 special days in November. As that season unfolded, none of us could have conceived that this would be the last time we would all meet here, and that for this deer camp, it was the beginning of the end. For my brother Jim, next season never came. In April, he was diagnosed with lung cancer, and by November was too weak to make the pilgrimage to deer camp. Jim's absence hung heavy on everyone's mind and heart. As we closed camp, none of us were thinking about next season. Jim passed away just after Christmas. I wasn't sure if the pain would be healed by the next season. We never got a chance to find out. In September, just as Mother Nature dusted off her palette of crimson and orange to paint the shoreline of the lake, my brother Gary was diagnosed with a tumor on a major blood vessel in his lung. After he left Tuesday morning, there was a pall over the camp the rest of the season. It was understood by all that deer camp would never be the same. Gary passed away in early December. With the heart and soul gone, a couple of the usual campmates did not come for the next season. Now with Rick and Terry gone, I was on my own, and I was truly lost. Like my two brothers, my mentors, my best friends, deer camp was dead. Driving to camp the Friday before the next opening day, I still wasn't sure how the season would unfold. Without the others in camp, I knew I would be hunting with ghosts, but I was not ready for the haunting quiet in the cabin. Like most nights before opening day, sleep did not come easy, but it was not because of the excitement of the moment. It was that discontenting quiet. Opening day was pleasantly uneventful. I saw the usual denizens of the woods, red squirrels, blue and gray jays, ravens, but no deer. Sometime during the day, however, I found my compass. I knew what I had to do. Each day I would choose a different area to hunt. Over the rest of the season, I would be able to make it to the places where we had hunted most and where the trophy memories and good times lay. It had come to me in the solitude of opening day that to go forward, I had to go back. There were goodbyes that needed to be said. What a season it was. I sat in Jim's stand south of Lake Ree, where he had shot several bucks, including a hefty 11-pointer. Then Porcupine Lake, where I pushed a 10-pointer to Gary, his buck of a lifetime. At every spot, I thought. I smiled. I laughed. I cried. I remembered. The last morning of the season, I was up early. Walking in the pre-dawn darkness, I could again sense that feeling of excitement which had been missing. I knew I was no longer lost. Over the course of the morning, I sat, I listened, I watched, I tracked, I hunted. As I walked out of the woods just before noon to close camp, I couldn't help but notice that though there was that familiar sadness the season was ending too soon, I was already looking forward to next November.
Ron Weber is an author and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, find out how the DNR's deer donation program works and how it helps address food insecurity in Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's gun deer season opened over the weekend, and with it comes the return of a DNR program for hunters to make venison donations to food pantries around the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we check out that program. Have you participated as a hunter? Have you made that donation? If you work at a processor that works with this program, love to hear from you. Or if you work at a food bank or use a food bank, has this come your way? Or if you have questions, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Brad Cooley is a wildlife damage specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Brad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Happy to be here.
What are the main features of this deer donation program? What happens?
Yeah, so this is the 23rd year of the program. The program started back in the year 2000. And since that time, hunters have donated over 97,000 deer to the program, which translates to approximately 3.8 million pounds of ground venison being distributed to food pantries across the state to help those in need. So great, great program.
And you've added, as you mentioned, 23 years now, you added a couple years ago a partners program to help find processors to deal with the deer to get it to into the food system. How does that work?
Yeah. So unfortunately, we're seeing a decrease in the number of processors, for various reasons. You know, we just don't have as many, licensed meat processors in the state. So 2 years ago, we created a partners program. And the idea of the partners program is any group or organization or individuals, they can rent a freezer truck and serve as a drop-off location. So that started 2 years ago in Marquette County, the Marquette County Land and Water Conservation Department and County Deer Advisory Council teamed up to have our first drop-off location. And like I said, it's just a spot, a business where they have a freezer truck and hunters can bring a deer, donate it, and then they transport it to one of our participating processors. So it's just a way to, with that decreasing number of processors, trying to fill in those gaps and make it convenient for hunters to donate and, get those deer to people in need.
Yeah, talk us through the nuts and bolts. If a hunter is listening and saying, yeah, I'd love to do this, what do they do?
Yeah, it's pretty simple for the hunter. Field dress your deer, register it like you normally would, and then take a look on the DNR's website. We have a list, go to the DNR's website, keyword search, deer donation program. We have all our drop-off locations posted on the DNR's website. This year we have 51 processors participating in the program and three additional drop-off locations. So look at one of those drop-off locations convenient and nearest to the hunter. Also look at the map that's on the DNR's website. We do, depending on if the deer was harvested in a county with chronic wasting disease, we do require testing, for some of the deer with chronic in counties that have chronic wasting disease. So This year, for example, there's 17 counties where adults and fawns are required to be tested for a chronic wasting disease, and 19 counties where just adults are. So take a look at that map on the DNR's website. If the deer does need to be tested for chronic wasting disease, go to one of our CWD testing locations or kiosks and have that sample pulled, and then take that deer to the processor and have it donated. You know, from there, the processor and the volunteers do the work. That deer is processed. The deer needs to be brought in whole. It's processed into ground venison, into 1 or 2 pound tubes of ground venison, and then volunteers distribute that to food pantries that have signed up and are willing and accepting that venison.
Some hunters might be thinking, this sounds great, but I do want to keep a trophy. Is that an option?
That's an option. Yep, you bet. We'll still make arrangements to allow you to keep the head and the cape of that deer if you need to. But yeah, certainly, we'll take any deer that hunters are willing to donate.
Talking to Brad Cooley from Wisconsin's DNR, looking at the DNR's deer donation program, 23rd year in existence, how it works, how people can participate. You can join in if you have at 800-642-1234 to tell us about it, or ask your questions, 800-642-1234. Now, I know we're just getting rolling here. Do you have any indication of how much deer is coming into this program so far this season?
Yeah, on average, the last 4 or 5 years, we'll see anywhere between 1,300 to 1,600 deer donated. I did call a few of our processors today just to see, what type of activity they had over opening weekend. And, most of our processors said that, the number of deer being donated are down or comparable to last year. However, those processors did say that the number of deer they're seeing is up. It's just that many hunters are choosing to have the deer processed and are retaining them themselves this year. So still a lot of deer hunting season left. So we're hopeful that, donation numbers will increase as we go through the season.
Now, I was looking at the maps of processors and food banks that end up using it. This is really, for the most part, a statewide operation, right?
Yeah, statewide. Like I said, we currently have 42 counties that we have either a processor participating or a drop-off location. But yeah, these processors are equipped and set up to take deer that are harvested anywhere in the state. So, certainly anywhere a hunter is harvesting deer or successful, we'll gladly take that deer and get it processed and donated to the food pantries.
Now, you mentioned the CWD, chronic wasting disease, a serious disease affecting deer in parts of the state. I've been following this story since I started producing here, and it was this brand new thing. Are we seeing, the number of counties with required testing increasing in recent years?
Yeah, unfortunately, we're seeing an increase in the number of counties where CWD has been detected. There's currently 60 counties where either a wild or captive deer has tested positive for chronic wasting disease or is within 10 miles. 37 counties have had an actual wild positive in them. So, yeah, unfortunately, we're seeing, an increase in the number of positives on the landscape. And we work with the Department of Health every year to set up testing requirements for deer donated to the deer donation program. So, like I mentioned this year, 19 counties require the testing of adult deer, and 17 counties require testing of adult and fawns that were harvested in those counties. So we're just trying to make sure that, obviously any deer that is being donated to the food pantries and to those in need is CWD free and safe for consumption.
Now, getting back to the donation program, is this only for gun deer season, or can bow hunters who might be hunting at a different time of the season also participate?
Yeah, great question. The program runs throughout the entire deer hunting season. So we start the program in September with the start of the archery season, and it'll continue actually all the way through January 31st, when those deer hunting seasons end in the metro unit. So at any point during those seasons, during that time frame, successful hunters can donate and bring in your deer.
Maybe this is a dumb question, but how about non-intentional taking of deer? The car crash that we all hope to avoid. Can that find its way into the deer donation system?
Yeah, unfortunately not. We only accept hunter harvested deer, and deer that were harvested in Wisconsin. So yeah, any car killed deer, any deer harvested in other states, those other sources, unfortunately cannot be donated through the program.
Makes sense. Now, we talked about how hunters can participate. If there are people listening who are processors or food banks who would like to tap into this, how do they get involved? Probably too late this year, but for 2023.
Yeah, if you're a licensed processor or a charitable organization, we'd love to have you participate. So processors just need to be licensed, you know, through Department of Agriculture. So they have to be a licensed processor. Any charitable organization has to be registered as a 501c3 nonprofit. If you're listening and you meet one of those qualifications, we'd love to hear from you. Again, go to the Deer Donation website on the DNR's website and find my contact information there. The other thing is, you know, not only hunters can obviously help through donation, but anybody else can help as well. There is an opportunity for individuals to make monetary donations to the Deer Donation Program. And of course, those monetary donations, you know, help to pay for some of those processing costs. So if you're in picking up a state park pass or, you know, registering a boat or ATV, you know, there is the option to also make a monetary donation to help, you know, support program costs.
Brad, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
Brad Cooley is wildlife damage specialist with the Wisconsin DNR. We talked with him about the state's deer donation program that stocks food pantries around Wisconsin. We've got a link, by the way, to find out more info about the program, plus their partners program for connecting hunters with processors. Find that at our website at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, mental health challenges can feel unique and isolating, but there are a lot of other people in the same situation, and they can provide help for one another. We'll hear more from a mental health expert who wrote the new book, You Are Not Alone. Plus, are Americans getting more angry over time? A Wisconsin anger expert looks back at 2022 in the political world and beyond, and the healthy uses of anger. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, how should the U.S. memorialize its own injustices? A writer takes us on a trip to Germany to learn how that country has tried to remember the Holocaust and to share possible lessons for the U.S. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.